Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Medieval Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I am here today with Claudine Chavanis-Mazel and Linda Aipilar to talk about their new book, The Green Middle Ages, The Depiction and Use of Plants in the Western World, 600 to 1600, out this year with the Amsterdam University Press. Hello, Claudine and Linda. How are you?
Hey, fine, thank you. May I just make one sort of a correction? I'm Claudine Chavanis-Mazel. It's French.
Claudine Chavanis-Mazel. And I'm sure it didn't do much better with Aipilar, but
it's good. Most of the times they completely say it wrongly, but yeah, perfect. Thank you.
All right, welcome. It's really nice to talk to you today. And actually, in a rare moment, we are all in Amsterdam.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, usually I'm doing this, I'm talking to somebody in California or who knows. So this is quite nice. We could be doing this right here in the same city. Doesn't matter. I mean, it's interesting. I'm still at my kitchen table and you're also somewhere, but
right.
Yeah.
Best place. Yeah.
Okay.
Very nice.
Very nice. All right. So my first question is, how did you two get together? Meet and decide to collaborate?
Well, it's in a way it's in a way it's when I became a professor in medieval art history in Amsterdam, the atmosphere was very much egalitarian. Students knew only my first name. Then there came a student named Linda to see me. She shook my hand very politely and was extremely to the point. It turned out she was a secretary of a big firm and simply knew how to behave. Wanted to start a BA. She was ambitious, serious, and worked exceptionally hard. And most of all, we had a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, Claudine, it's so nice to hear this. Yeah, Claudine was a professor at the University of Amsterdam, and I was indeed an art history student at that time. I completed both my bachelor's and master thesis under her guidance, and I graduated with honors. And yeah, we have known each other since 2010.
Oh, all right. So is this book something that you covered in class then?
No, not at all.
No, well, it's a short and a long story.
Claudine and I got along very well. And after my graduation, the plan arose with Claudine to create an exhibition on manuscripts and early printed works. And manuscripts and early printed works that are mainly in Dutch libraries and institutions, they are hardly visible to the public.
And I think it's not fair that we know our Rembrandts but don't know anything about medieval book illustration in our libraries, and they are so beautiful. So my interest started 100 years ago with my love for a medieval manuscript with plant illustration when I was a student. The curator of the Leiden University Library, he showed me a 6th century manuscript with a miniature of a cyclamen. It took my breath away. Unbelievable. So it became my dream to write my thesis about medieval manuscript illustration because it was so unknown. So I did, and in the end, I became a professor in art history at the University of Amsterdam. And the funny thing is, plant illustration hardly appealed to art historians at that time, no way. No famous painters like Rembrandt or Vermeer did anything about plants. However, plant kept attracting me. 10 years ago, when I wanted to make an exhibition on plant illustration, there was still no main interest. The museum director commented, "Oh no, there will be no visitors." By now, green is a modern topic. And recently, we had a fantastic exhibition in the Museum Krona in Uden, which is in the south of the Netherlands, and it was a fantastic exhibition. So, okay.
So, and then as it turned out, you were right. You could get an exhibition together and people would want to come. And as it turns out, you could. There's definitely a book here. In fact, so you two are the editors, but you're joined by several other scholars, right? And I'm curious, like, how did you go about collecting these people and deciding what would be included?
Yeah, we wanted to review a number of aspects, which resulted in chronological development, the use of plants, plants in literature, and plants in book illumination. And we already knew the art historians, and we found expertise amongst others Gerda van Uffelen and Gerard Thijssen. They both worked at Hortus, and Gerard worked at the Naturalis Museum. They both know the botanical world, which has its own way of research and their own scientific language, and that we as art historians, we don't master that. So it was a great opportunity to work with both of them and also to learn a lot from them. And we also contacted Jan-Willem Briet, who was a doctor with great interest in history. And one of his projects was to find out more about medieval recipes and whether they were still effective. So very interesting to know that. And for example, St. John's wort was used since the ancient Greeks for its antidepressant properties. And it has proven its value, and today we still use it.
Cool. So these, and there's a lot of these scholars are Dutch or local as well, right? From kind of all over, which makes this feel like a community collaboration. That's very nice.
Yes.
Yeah, and before we go any further, if you could just tell our listeners kind of what this book covers. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. What's the subject material?
Okay. The various authors of this book focus on the period between the 6th and the 16th century. So it's quite before the printing era. And on manuscripts in European libraries, museums, universities, private collections, especially in the Low Countries, but it's universal as well. And one of the main goals of the Green Middle Ages is to make these manuscripts known to a wider public. There's not only the content, but also the book itself. The Green Middle Ages contains a series of articles by scholars of various disciplines about how plants were used, what formed the foundation of this knowledge. And as I said, the medieval manuscripts form the core of every chapter. And what is so special, the majority of their illustrations are published here for the first time. We had to order photographs from all over the world. It took us months to get that done. And it's all indeed new. And the nice thing is that this book can be used by both scholars and non-scholars. It contains so many interesting illustrations that if you scroll through the book, you want to read something more about it. So this book is also interesting to the general public.
Yeah, I mean, and this isn't a question, this is just a comment. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful. It's enormous. It's a huge volume, beautifully illustrated. And every time I open it, I see something else I want to just stare at for a while and then read about.
Keep on opening it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and I thought immediately of several people in my life who would love to have a copy. You know, I know so many gardeners and what have you. And just, it is a wonderful book. So listeners, you don't want this one on Kindle. You want to get a hold of it. That's wonderful. Okay. So let's get into some of the arguments that you make. So you write in here that classical antiquity is the base of knowledge for the medieval world. And I think most people tend to see, you know, a lot of people think of the medieval world as the Dark Ages, right? But you would argue not at all. Yes. Can you comment on that?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's so colorful. Yeah, the Western tradition is based upon Dioscorides, a Greek doctor who lived in the first century. And Dioscorides, he wrote the Materia Medica. And as a physician, he collected 600 plants and more than 2,000 recipes, really a lot. And he obtained his information from earlier writings, local sources, and his own experience. And his knowledge remained normative for the Western world until the late 18th century. And also Pliny the Elder, who died in Pompeii at the outbreak of the Vesuvius. Yeah, that's 79 Christian era, was of vital importance. Pliny wrote an encyclopedia consisting of 37 volumes titled the Naturalis Historia, with facts about nature and the cosmos. And he used as many of the sources as Dioscorides knew about. Then we have, the 4th century saw the work of the Apuleius Platonicus, which was a compilation of earlier writers, including Pliny and Dioscorides. And Apuleius copied everything from his predecessors and ending up with some sort of small encyclopedia of 150 plants called the Herbarius. And he included the names of plants in different regions of Europe, which even today is quite handy. as a compact illustrated text, it served as a very practical manual or reference work used by the monastics, whose task it was to care for the poor and sick. And their medical care was mainly based on these ancient texts. The information did not always have a reliable character. This is probably due to the fact that this is a compilation of texts that had previously been passed down orally. And for a good example, for instance, is the advice to tie a bunch of plantain under the chin in case of a headache. reliable or not, the Apuleius Platonicus work became the manual of choice for monastics, and many copies can be found in medieval monastery libraries.
And from them found their way to public libraries, especially in France.
Yeah.
So, and there's another underlying very important thing, is that one of the rules of Benedictine cloisters was that the inhabitants had to write and read aloud. And for that reason, works by classical authors written in Latin were collected in Christian monasteries and were copied time and again, over and over. Knowledge in Latin spread around Europe together with the Christians and also the lettering. The task of copying text was taken over by universities from the 12th century onwards. Arabic of Arab academics texts became very popular with the school of Salerno in Italy and Spain in the 12th century, and with them the theory, and that's too complicated a story to dive into, but there's the theory of the four humors was reintroduced. Humoral theory was a unified theory of medicine before the invention of modern medicine for more than 2,000 years. is a system invented by Hippocrates and Galenus, who explain that man has four humors dominated by blood, phlegm, black, and yellow bile. And to keep a human in balance, you need to eat certain plants. So, for example, if you have a phlegmatic temperament, you need to eat sweet melon. That gives you a sort of boost. Mustard is beneficial for people with a cold and wet temperament, such as the elderly in winter in the mountains. So it goes on. So they're very strange stories, but still, sometimes you can understand it, sometimes you can't.
Well, I'll keep that in mind as I age. I need more mustard in my diet.
Yeah,
good idea.
So I'm seeing medical books, right? These tend to be medical books. Is this it? What kind of books from the classical era make it through to the medieval and then the case more?
Yeah, it's much more than just medicine. All the texts that have survived are about practical knowledge, for instance, food, medicine, pigments, literature like Ovid, whatever, and religious and history. So, and we've got many, many of those texts that will everyone who is interested in ancient texts will tell me. But next to the encyclopedias by Dioscorides, Pliny, and Apuleius, there are so many, many sources. And I will tell you one of a very strange story. Astonishing Survival is a first century cookbook attributed to Marcus Gravius Apicius, which was copied by mere chance in the 9th century, and then again in the 15th century, and then it became printed. From him, we know all sorts of recipes. For instance, an easy one. Boiled carrots are served with salt, pure oil, and vinegar. That's okay, isn't it? Or more complicated, soup of lettuce leaves and onions. Boil the vegetable in water with baking soda. Wring them out. Chop finely. In a mortar, grind pepper, lovage seed, celery seed, dried mint, onion, garum, oil, and wine, and then it's okay. You can visit all these recipes in online today. And you've got another source?
Yeah, Ovid. Ovid in his Metamorphoses, he describes the dinner which the poor Philemon and Baucis prepare for two travelers who arrive at their home. So it's also a famous story. They do not know, but it will turn out that the travelers are caught. And Philemon cleans the table with a bunch of freshly picked mint herb and places their olives, endive, radishes, cottage cheese, and eggs, which were briefly swirled in the ashes. In the center, Philemon places a honeycomb, and after the main course, nuts, figs, dried dates, prunes, apples, and grapes. So, yeah.
A good
meal. Yes.
And there are also religious texts.
Yeah.
It's very simple. The Bible is an old text. Mm-hmm. And there are over 100 plants mentioned in the Bible. And you know of palm trees, olive trees, and maybe about burning bushes. Lesser known is the mandrake. Maybe you have heard about it from Harry Potter.
Yeah, it was in a Harry Potter book.
It's a plant whose roots look like a human being, and it was famous for its love-inducing effect. When used too much, one will die. It will scream when harvested and will kill everybody around it.
It's nice for Harry Potter.
Yeah. Well, he has those things on his
list. Oh, yeah.
It already appears in the Old Testament when Jacob's wife Rachel asked the other wife, Jacob, Leah, if her son will bring some mandrake apples from the field. And the love potion works. The result is her first child, Joseph, later followed by Benjamin. And also other, many, many, many other authors like Shakespeare used that in Romeo and Juliet, but that's not ancient anymore, so I stop.
All right. So loads, they're absolutely all over is what I'm seeing.
Yeah,
these mentions are everywhere. That's, of course, the Bible. I hadn't thought about that as a source. That's fabulous source. There's a really fun story. There's this character named Euphemerism, who, along with Isidore Seville, they play an essential role in translating from the classical to the medieval era. Can you talk to me about this? What happens here?
Yeah, well, yeah, Isidor of Seville is indeed, one of the most crucial links between classical antiquity and the Middle Ages. And he lived in the 7th century and was Archbishop of Seville. He wrote it's very difficult to pronounce. It is an encyclopedia of 20 books and compiled everything he considered of value in classical heritage. And we are talking about 10 centuries of knowledge. The interesting thing is that Isidore, for example, writes about the god Apollo as the founder of medical science, but makes no mention of a methodological provenance. Isidore introduces other persons who had to do with medical science and interweaves then the classical world with the medieval era. As an archbishop, Isidore would not recognize pagan gods as Apollo or Artemis. Isidore placed their tradition into a fictional historical context without a hint of divinity. This effort is called euhemerism, which presumes that mythological accounts originated from historical events. This euhemerism is named after the Greek writer Euhemerus, and who lived in the 3rd century before the Christian era.
Yes, and because of his great authority and influence, the Encyclopedia of Isidore was one of the most popular, frequently read books of the Middle Age. It was read, copied, printed far into the Renaissance. So it's only after 1500 that Isidore was overtaken by authors with a more modern and science-based approach.
Okay. And the encyclopedia is exactly what modern people would think an encyclopedia is, right? It's this list of things that's... And
I think even Isidore is now the god of, or the protector of the computer.
Oh!
That's what the Roman clergy has said that.
I should pray to him more often, or I guess I'm willing to sacrifice a lot to him if that will save my computer trouble.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, that is good to know.
Yeah.
Things I learned during this podcast. Okay, so we've got this huge source material that comes from the classical world, is added to in the Middle Ages, is understood, translated. So loads of people are using them, right? So let's start with monastics. What do people in monasteries use this plant knowledge for?
Well, in a way, it's an easy answer. Monastic use their knowledge to heal people and to feed the poor, those two. Almost all their knowledge was based on the classical authors. So the monastic garden was filled with herbs created by God, of course, known to the monks from generation to generation, and from which they permitted to make medicines. And the options of monks was limited. They were not allowed to cut into flesh, etc. They could practice bloodletting and administer laxatives, stimulate sweating and vomiting, but nothing more. It was important that none of the interventions should lead to the death of a patient. You can understand that. Experimentations with medicine were therefore risky and better avoided. So monastic stuck to the traditional prescriptions. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we have these monasteries who use them. And then in the high Middle Ages, we see the rise of the university as, several important European cities get universities, develop university faculties, many still within a religious context, right? And this kind of knowledge becomes the province of scholars. So what is it our forebears do with it?
Maybe you had forebears from the monastic area as well, but we never know.
Yes.
Universities were quite aware of their responsibility. One should not simply copy a recipe, but test it first. So more important even, readership and audience changed from the monasteries to citizens and universities. Now it's no longer just the monks who can read and write, but normal people who want to know what is healthy. So there will be a plant book for the laity. with pretty pictures. So it's nice to collect them, and it's nice to collect plants, and it's nice to discuss it with in between each other instead of understanding only authority.
Okay. And then this we see, I mean, to continue our chronological story, we see more the rise of the printing press means that more of this information goes elsewhere, right? And now just wealthy, educated citizens who can read now have this knowledge. And what's of interest to them?
Well, yeah, if you could read, you like to read How to Stay Healthy, and had a book copied on health. So from 1450, 1500, one could buy a printed book. And for example, the Tarquinium Sanitatis, not only for reading, but also for visual pleasure. Yeah, with the nice illustrations in it. And some copies were really richly decorated. In this book, one could read about the effects of food, the seasons, and the regions where the product is effective. For example, garlic is effective against poison and intestinal worms, but bad for the eyes, also bad for the brain, the kidneys, and the lungs. And moreover, it causes thirst. These ill effects can be counterbalanced, we read that, by combining it with vinegar and oil. And it was also important when traveling to find the right plant abroad. Then the Apuleius herbarium could come in handy, as different names are mentioned next to each plant. So that was really handy at that time.
So household management, kind of the same thing you're seeing monastics doing as well, just in a domestic sphere. All right. So, Linda, what was your favorite thing? What was your favorite part of working on this book?
Oh, difficult question. It's difficult to only mention one thing. There are so many interesting aspects. It was interesting to dive into the medieval world. And the piece I wrote was out of sheer curiosity about medieval depictions of plants from a 12th century book. And I didn't quite understand what was depicted, not quite what was meant to be allowed to, explore that. That was exciting. Why, for example, does a depicted tree look like someone has drawn peacock feathers? Yeah, at first it doesn't look like a drawn tree at all. And after literature research, it turns out that the author painted a palm tree with deep symbolic meaning. And of course, yeah, it's fun to then pass on that knowledge to others. We do that through this book, but also gave lecture series in Leiden with a PowerPoint for an audience. It was also great fun to teach children about this subject. And the book has triggered a lot. I found the cooperation with Claudine to be special. And we were always cheerful and positive at work over many years.
Yes.
Many years.
Yeah. Also with the other authors.
With the other authors, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's special, right? This process of doing, I love it when I talk to people who've edited a book together and they're still friends.
Oh, yes, we are. We've lost a few, but...
No. She's joking.
Yeah, Claudine, same question for you.
Yeah, well, diving into a new subject is always exciting. I was trained as a professor in Christian iconography to tell you how does Christ look like, what about Mary, and why does she stand on the left hand of the cross and why on the right hand, and whatever. I can explain entire portals in French cathedrals for you. So this was quite sort of new. But the manuscripts in question were really beautifully illustrated, and many had never been published before. So it was a discovery after a discovery. We kept on saying, oh, wow. And at the same time, many scholars are working on the history of medicine. That's not a new subject. And so want to know about the content of a manuscript, but few are interested in the manuscripts themselves. Art historians have no feeling for the illustrations, since most of them, and maybe all, are copies from earlier manuscripts, and thus have no artistic quality.
But he's making a gesture.
Pure frustration. This is nonsense, yeah. Is what that gesture said.
So it's especially people who are interested in manuscripts, the subject of a handwritten book. That's of fantastic interest. So that was fantastic. And together, working together with various specialists in this field was the most enjoyable thing. So,
yeah. So, yeah. All right. This sounds great. It sounds like it was a really good experience.
Yes, yes, yes.
Of course. Yeah. Yes, it is.
So what's going on? What's next? Are we still working with plants? Will there be more exhibitions? Or have you moved on to something else now?
Well, yeah, plants will always be our interest. But the focus on green plants today, more people will dive into the green material. And in 2013, there was no interest in plants. Now it's a topic these days. Yeah.
And also, I think people will get more interest in people like, what's her name? The woman I don't like, Hildegard van Bingen. Everybody knows about Hildegard van Bingen. She is so fantastic. But in medicine and plant history, she didn't mean a lot. But I want to learn more about why is it so important in her time and why people think now that she's important. And I think she's not important, but I have to explain that, I think. So the academic world changes with popularity and women, especially women. And I can say that because we are women. All the time there will be new discoveries. And that's what is so fascinating.
Yeah, wonderful. So I have one last question. Do you know about the woman who's doing the urban herbology course in Park Frekendal?
No, but there are many courses and places where you can study the green material as a high value thing in the world. And I think it will become more and more important because in the end we will only eat vegetables, maybe. but it's always a good idea. But keep in mind that a few hundred years ago, we didn't drink coffee. We didn't drink tea. We had never heard about tomatoes until Columbus brought them home. We did not know about potatoes, ananas, corn, whatever. One did never eat raw vegetables. No raw vegetables. So plant food has changed fundamentally. So it will keep on changing. And at the same time, I think that that supermarkets will also learn their lessons. So I hope.
We hope. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. This was absolutely delightful.
Thank you for having us.
You're too kind. It was quite nice.
Yeah. I could tell you weren't sure about it, but no, it was lovely.
We'll see.
Thank you very much for the interview.
It was fun to do.
Yeah, really fun.
Our listeners, once again, it's the Green Middle Ages. Out with Amsterdam University Press. There'll be a link on our website to help you get your hands on it, and definitely check it out. This is not only are you going to want to read it, you're going to want to gift it. There is a gardener in your life who'll want it. But all right, thanks very much. And once again, all right, take care, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye bye.